Slowly, with the help of Dean Kraft, the patient and helpful facilities manager, FBI Agent O'Brien was catching on to the computer talk everyone at Cornell was throwing around. It gradually dawned on O'Brien that the real evidence in this case wasn't to be found among the suspect's personal effects. It was all on the computer. But one of the problems he gathered was that Morris had encrypted nearly all of his files, and not only had he encrypted them, but with few exceptions, he had also compressed them first. He shrank them by running them through a special program that made them even more difficult to decipher. By one estimate, O'Brien heard, it would take scientists at the National Security Agency, the Center of Cryptography, 200 years to decrypt Morris's files. The information O'Brien got from his sources turned out to be out of date. Kraft's first step was to get CryptBreaker's Workbench, a program to break encryptions. With the help of the program, Kraft was able to break the encryption and give Cornell access to all versions of the Morris worm. The process took less than a day. The matter of the anonymous call to the New York Times was also becoming clearer. The FBI had obtained Robert's long-distance telephone record, and it appeared that that night he had called someone at Harvard named Paul Graham. Special Agent O'Brien couldn't muster much sympathy for this Morris fellow, even if he was as brilliant as people said. All that talk of an innocent backpack-carrying kid who made a mistake didn't move O'Brien. At 22, the agent figured, a man should be considered a responsible adult. At that age, O'Brien was already a full-time parole officer putting himself through graduate school, and he didn't think much of Morris's Harvard friends either. When he flew to Boston soon after the incident to interview Paul Graham and Andy Suddeth, he found Graham first, in his office at the Aiken Computer Center. When O'Brien introduced himself, Graham was unfriendly and uncooperative. "I don't think I want to get involved in this," he told the agent. "But you are involved, Paul," O'Brien responded. "You dropped a dime on your buddy." Paul stood his ground. "Well, I'd rather not talk to you." O'Brien nodded, reached into his pocket, and produced a piece of paper. "Paul," he said, "would you mind telling me if I spelled your name right?" He handed Graham the piece of paper. "What's that?" Graham asked as he took the paper from O'Brien. His eyes widened. It was a subpoena summoning Paul to Syracuse to testify before a federal grand jury. O'Brien had to smile at the young man's ignorance. Most people to whom he served subpoenas knew that it was coming the instant O'Brien reached into his pocket. By reflex, they would put both hands over their heads and take a step backward to avoid being served. "It's a subpoena, and we'll see you in Syracuse next week." "And what if I don't come?" Graham sounded irritated. "Then I'll be back with an arrest warrant." Andy Suddeth was more gracious, but he too declined to be interviewed. He was served a subpoena as well. On the morning of the grand jury testimony, Suddeth and Graham were late. The assistant U.S. attorney, Andy Baxter, began to show concern. "What time does their flight get in?" he asked O'Brien. "What flight?" O'Brien asked. "I heard they're driving." The prosecutor looked confused. "It's a 6-hour drive. You didn't tell them that they can fly and the government reimburses them?" "Gee, that must have slipped my mind," O'Brien said, barely concealing his lack of sympathy for the young men. When the two witnesses did arrive, they had to spend some time warming up. The heater in Paul's car was broken. They had stopped several times along the way to warm their hands and once to buy Andy a warmer jacket. When they heard that the government would have paid their airfare, both were furious. In December, Robert agreed to give a proffer, a statement to the government detailing everything he had done. It was an unusual concession from someone suspected of committing a crime, but Robert and Guidoboni thought that full cooperation might soften the Justice Department. O'Brien and Gibbons were ready for him. One of the Bureau's interrogation experts flew to Syracuse beforehand to coach the two agents on effective questioning techniques. O'Brien had already seen a videotape of the lecture Robert Morris had given half a year earlier to the NSA on computer security. Part of the lecture had been called How Not to Get Caught. "Isn't it kind of strange," O'Brien asked the suspect, "that you're giving a talk like that on how not to get caught, and you're sitting here right now?" Robert looked down at his hands and smiled. He had no answer. Shortly before Christmas, Guidoboni called Alan Rubin, the defense attorney in Los Angeles, representing Kevin Mitnick, who had been arrested earlier in the month for breaking into digital computers and stealing proprietary software. The lawyers didn't know each other, and their clients were clearly spun of different cloth. yet there was so little existing case law for the computer crime statute that Guido Boni thought he and Rubin might be able to exchange a few ideas. As it turned out, the two attorneys could only commiserate and wish each other luck. With just a handful of keystrokes, Robert not only had paralyzed thousands of computers, but had brought his life to a standstill as well. Returning to Cornell, continuing to attend classes and starting work on his dissertation were, of course, out of the question. By Thanksgiving, Robert had withdrawn from Cornell, his career as a computer scientist on hold indefinitely. Between Christmas and New Year's, Bob and Anne took him to Cornell to pack up his things. He moved in with his parents and got a programming job at a private international development agency, accompanying his mother on her 3-hour daily commute into Washington. Cornell, in the meantime, in a measure to guard against civil lawsuits from victims of the worm, embarked on an extensive inquiry. By February, the university had issued a 45-page report on the incident, which concluded that Robert Morris had violated the university's computer use policy. As if that weren't enough, Robert had to go through an academic disciplinary hearing. Cornell formally suspended Robert. He would be eligible to reapply for admission in the fall of 1990. In an aside during the academic hearing, Dean Kraft asked Robert about the keyword he had used to encrypt his files. "It's in the dictionary," Robert told him. Kraft ran the dictionary through the encryption mechanism, compared the output, and found the word. It was simple.